Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Justice Department is planning to overturn movie distribution rules dating back from the late 1940s that prohibited the eight largest studios from owning theaters. The Justice Department views the rules, known as Paramount consent decrees, as essentially obsolete in the age of streaming. The changes could shed new light on how streaming affects the film industry. Brooks Barnes is the Hollywood reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering the story. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
So the decrees were imposed after the U.S. government won a landmark Supreme Court decision in United States versus Paramount Pictures in 1948. What was the conflict about?
The conflict was about studios or these big Hollywood companies controlling every part of the supply chain from production to retail. So they made the movies and then they put them out in theater. They also owned the theaters, which allowed them a lot of power in terms of setting prices and freezing out competitors.
Right, competitors that weren't making the movies.
Correct.
And how did the decrees work?
So the Supreme Court ruling was in 1948, and then between that ruling and 1952, the big studios at the time agreed to these rules, basically known as the Paramount Consent Decrees, that included all sorts of things. They didn't outright ban theater ownership, but they very difficult for studios to do that. They had to sell their theater chains, but it also prohibited things like what's known in Hollywood as block booking, which is where a studio says you have to take all of my movies, whether you want them or not, basically the good with the bad.
Sounds like the bundling we get on cable, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Yes. And now increasingly with streaming, where you have to, you know, you pay one price and sort of get a lot of stuff that you probably don't want.
Right. So what is the expected impact of revoking the rules?
In Hollywood, not much at the moment. The rules have been considered obsolete for a while, it's very unlikely you'll see a Hollywood studio go out and buy a theater chain, in part because the chains are now so big, but also because it's kind of seen as a dying business, or at least a flat business. What they really care about in Hollywood these days are building their streaming services, Disney Plus, the coming HBO Max, which is Warner Brothers. But that raises a whole other set of questions.
About the streaming services.
Well, it's interesting. So they're saying, the Justice Department saying, you know, we want to end the consent decrees that, what we just talked about. But when you think about it, it's kind of the same system that's emerging here with streaming, where Disney, for example, is going to be putting all of its content on its own streaming service. So that's really doing the same thing, and it is controlling the chain from beginning to end. The difference, I guess, is that anyone can, with the internet, a high speed internet connection, can connect. You're not, beholden to a certain set of controls. If that makes sense.
Except for people who don't have access to high speed internet or have a lot of restrictions on what they're able to get out in the hinterlands.
Absolutely. And also, if you don't want to subscribe to, 10 different streaming services, increasingly you have to, the companies are making them their own little walled cities, where if you want The Office, for example, you can no longer see it on Netflix. NBC Universal, which owns that show, has moved it to its own service coming soon. It's a different era with technology for sure, but it's something that some people are starting to say, there could be an instance where this also needs regulation.
Right. Same problem as pre-1948, but a different set of different factors. Some want the Justice Department to update the rules to address the streaming industry. Are streaming services regulated at all?
Not in terms of whether or not, nowhere near like this. There's a little bit of the streaming services wanting to not draw that scrutiny, so they're playing by the rules. But as they get bigger, it's just sort of a natural progression that, the bigger a company gets, the more it's able to sort of flout and be aggressive.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking with the New York Times reporter Brooke Barnes about plans by the Justice Department to overturn movie distribution rules dating from the late 1940s that prohibited back then the eight largest studios from owning theaters. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now the issue is what's controlling the big streaming services. What kind of regulation? Well, let me ask you this first, Brooke Barnes. Who are the watchdogs that want the Justice Department to update the rules? Who are those people or organizations out there?
Sure. There are people like, all sorts of everyone from the people who are concerned about what children watch and consumerism that way. There's a digital advocacy group called Public Knowledge. Those are really where the scrutiny is starting, or the conversation is rising up from.
And what do they want?
They want people, it's unclear. there's not a specific, we want this court ruling or this law. Mm-hmm. But they're talking about the idea that even though is known as the consent decrees that governed movie distribution going back to the 40s, even though they may be outdated, as the Justice Department is saying, the idea that a company bulk producing content, a studio, and then controlling distribution is not outdated. They're saying perhaps we should reapply the consent decree idea to streaming rather than just saying, it's outdated, let's just write it off the books.
There's arguments that have been made that the consent decrees that were brought about by U.S. versus Paramount Pictures in 1948 also helped bring about the downfall of the big studios, that one of the ways that they stabilized their income was to own the theaters and control mm-hmm. the distribution and so forth. Same thing with the streaming services. That's their bread and butter, right?
It will be. At the moment, they're putting enormous amount of money into building them. Disney, I think, has spent $3 billion in the last quarter. I'm not, don't quote me on that, but billions of dollars to build these services. At the moment, they're not profitable, but they believe, they will be.
They think they will be, yeah.
Especially as cable continues to decline, which is the way that most of these companies make most of their money now.
Are we headed into a time when, if it goes unregulated, that most of the stuff that we see, most of the movies we see, will be produced by streaming services eventually, and that we'll only be able to see those movies if we buy that streaming service? Is that the concern?
That's a big concern, especially for anything that's not a big blockbuster movie that's aimed at all audiences. The smaller art movie or the mid-budget movie, comedies, dramas, those were already seeing moving to streaming. And so the exhibition community theaters are pretty adamant about holding holding the line in terms of exclusivity and that's a problem too in terms of the streaming companies. Netflix want a shorter time in theaters and quicker to streaming.
And they have some sway. I mean, that's one of the ways that streaming's affected the larger film industry, right?
For sure. Like this season, The Irishman is Martin Scorsese's big new movie, and it's only in limited run in theaters.
Right.
It arrived tomorrow on Netflix, but because they could not come to an agreement with the big chains over how long it would play exclusively in theaters, that's just mostly skipping theaters. And there are two other big Netflix movies this Oscar season that could factor into Best Picture at the Academy Awards that mostly play on televisions and in mobile devices.
And the rule change could affect independent movie theaters. There are a few here in Columbus. Why would it affect independent movie theaters?
So that's the independent theaters are already in a pretty precarious spot, right?
Right.
And so anything that, you know, where the big chains could withstand certain terms from a studio, say a Disney requiring them to play the new Star Wars movie. I'm just using this as a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that hypothetical that, you know, Disney requires, if you want our new Star Wars movie, you have to play it for 3 weeks in a row. Okay. Well, that might be fine for a big chain, but if you're a single screen theater, by that third weekend or even second, you may not be, it just may not be economically, suitable for you. So the worry is that when the consent decrees go away and there's a sunsetting period, that the studios could return to that sort of block booking mentality, or another industry term is called clearance, which I like because it kind of makes me laugh, which is so Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
They call it clearance, but it's almost the opposite, which is control. Where they say, well, we'll let Star Wars play in this theater multiplex, but no one else in the region can have it.
Could streaming services start buying theaters?
They could. Netflix already has looked at different chains, in part to get around the big ones who are saying no. You know, you have to play by our rules.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Netflix owns one theater here in Hollywood, the Egyptian. But it's unlikely that a streaming service like Netflix would buy a big exhibition company like Regal or AMC or Cinemark, just because it is the opposite of what they're saying that their focus is, which is immediacy.
There is though. I mean, you know, I love going to the theater and seeing a movie with you know the public.
Sure.
Do we know what? You know, if that's stabilized, it's also like we have great chairs now that recline and
right.
Everything. You know, they serve you at your seat. But is that the film industry responding to the convenience thing with kind of the luxuries that they provide now?
That's one way that they're trying to
mm-hmm.
is, you know, making it less. I mean, they're selling an inconvenient a product when you think about it, you know, compared to a, you know, you can push a button in your living room
and I get to watch it on a huge screen, and
that's what they're doubling down on.
Mm-hmm.
So better technology in the projection, better sound, reclining chairs, alcohol, all of that kind of thing is something that is what theaters are hoping, because at a certain point they can't. They've reached a point where it's difficult to raise ticket prices.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can only charge so much for popcorn. they're constantly testing that threshold. But, yeah.
Well, Brooks Barnes, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Brooks Barnes. He's a Hollywood reporter for the New York Times. We've been talking about plans by the Justice Department to rescind movie distribution rules that date from the late 1940s that prohibited the big studios from owning theaters. We've been talking about what the impact is on the business and on the streaming services that are becoming kind of the giants in the business. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at wosu.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Google and the largest U.S. nonprofit hospital network have partnered in a deal that, among other things, gives the tech giant access to patient health data. So-called Project Nightingale provides Google access to the medical records of more than 50 million people across 21 states. Google says the deal will enhance productivity and patient safety, but others are concerned about securing the data. Sarah Needleman covered the story for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Sarah Needleman.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the partnerships between Google and Ascension, how long has this been going on?
Well, this project has been in the works for about a year. My colleague Rob Copeland did most of the heavy lifting, and what he found that so far about 150 Google employees have already had much of access to this data, and it's been in the works for quite some time.
When we talk about access to the data, what does that look like? What are they seeing?
Sure. Well, we're talking about data in terms of people's, you know, patients' names, dates of birth, their complete health history. And so basically the way the project works is that it's designed to put all the store of this information in the cloud. But it goes even further because it's using artificial intelligence and machine learning. So what we learned is that Google executives basically describe the goal as a layer of patient information that's essentially an entire personal health record. So AI would jump in with suggested questions and its own answers, such as risks of a given treatment plan. And then Project Nightingale would automatically predict and map the outcome of a certain procedure or certain medications.
Google says that it's about productivity and patient safety. So I get the patient safety part because AI could jump in and say, wait, no, you have a pacemaker, you can't have that done, or you're taking the wrong kind of medication or something like that, right?
That is possible. Basically, there would be like a search engine similar to the, you know, flagship Google search engine. You would type in a name. Google will produce a drop-down menu featuring patients with similar names, and you home in on the right person, and you get metabolic data, medications, phone numbers, even the patient's temperature. And so you could use that information to make judgment calls that could potentially help save a person's life or provide them on the right path to recovery.
When we talk about data in this day and age, we're talking about the monetization of it. I mean, how do you make money off of it? Google is not nonprofit.
This is true.
What are they going to do with it?
Well, right now, Google is not being paid for the work that it's doing, but Ascension is incurring costs as it trains its staff in, in Google systems. At some point, it is likely that there will be money exchanging hands. This is like the early days. The idea is to replicate this with other healthcare systems besides Ascension. So Ascension is sort of like the guinea pig. And then the question is, what are they going to do with this data? Could they monetize it in some way, shape, or form? And Google has said that they are not looking to sell it to advertisers. But there could be other potential uses for the data that we're not thinking of that could maybe be helpful, you know, to other businesses, and that Google could sell it to them for, like I said, for ways we haven't possibly fathomed.
Well, and they say they're not looking to, but would anything bar them from selling to advertisers?
Well, I mean, there are certain legal hurdles that would go there. Certainly, and in the public eye, it would be considered problematic. But, you know, consider, for example, that Google's YouTube unit agreed in September to pay $170 million in fines and change its practices in response to complaints that it illegally collected data on children mm-hmm. to sell ads. So, you know, there's certain boundaries of what you can collect and what you can't collect. So maybe they would be able to sell certain data pertaining to adults. But you also have to keep in mind that there are laws, like HIPAA, for example, that does allow the, healthcare providers to share information with third parties under certain conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And so advertising, I would imagine, would not fall under the normal conditions. Of course, bear in mind that law was created before Google even existed.
Right. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Wall Street Journal tech reporter Sarah Needleman about the collaboration between Google and the largest U.S. nonprofit hospital network, Ascension, in a deal that, among other things, gives the tech giant access to patient health data. It's called Project Nightingale. If you have a question or comment about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Okay, so one of the issues with all of this, Sarah, is that Google and Ascension didn't tell patients or doctors that they were doing this, right?
Correct. They kept it secret, and they have argued that they did nothing wrong because HIPAA, which is the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 96, that generally allows hospitals to share data with business partners without telling patients, as long as the information is used to help the coveted entity carry out its healthcare functions. So we spoke to some privacy experts who said that Project Nightingale does appear to be permissible under federal law. But again, as I said, you know, that law dates back to 1996, and the question is whether or not in today's day and age that still makes sense.
And you mentioned early on that 150 Google employees have had access to all this data. There's obviously concern it could just be stolen, right?
Well, they have access to the data through Ascension, through this project. But, you know, the question is, who are these employees? What kind of data exactly do they have access to? Are they vetted? What could be how secure is the system? What do we know in terms of hacking? And we've seen cases of employees going rogue. And when we're talking about something such a large amount of data and private data for millions of Americans,
right,
then the issue is very sensitive, and you really want to look more closely at who these people are and whether or not they should be handling such information.
Hmm. Let's see. Mary from Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I am just rather appalled by this and very scared of its implications. For example, it could give even more and perhaps more opaque ability for health insurance companies to ration medical care, because they could say, well, you haven't responded to your treatment by this date, and our models that Google has given the data to our actuaries, and they've put it in big black box opaque predictive analytics models, and they say that there's not a high enough percentage of patients who succeed, and therefore you don't get any more treatment. And, you know, I know in my family's case, we seem to need 1 week longer than all of the existing guidelines for treatment to respond to things. And if a doctor or a therapist has that judgment, well, yeah, okay, I'll give you another week to respond to this therapy. We always do. But, you know.
You're worried that it'll become too automatic. Is there, Sarah Needleman, has that been raised as an issue, the issue of sharing the data with insurance companies and having them use it?
That hasn't come up because at this point the data, the sharing is only between Ascension and Google.
Mm-hmm.
I am not familiar with Ascension's policies and how it works exactly with insurers, but I think it's a fair question to ask. I think there are a lot of questions that people are curious about and want answers to, especially in a situation where it comes at them as a surprise and not a chance to have their say or just some sort of open situation where we can pose these sort of questions. So I think it's a fair one to ask, but I don't know the exact answer.
So when you're describing Project Nightingale and what it would do and the fact that Ascension needed a search engine, and why not go to the biggest search engine in the world and get them to do the job for you, that makes sense. They're saying it improves the healthcare delivery system, right?
Right, and I have spoken to some doctors who are in favor of it,
mm-hmm.
who think that right now it is very difficult if you're treated in one hospital, let's say you're out of town, and then you go back home, or even if it's in the town, but just going to your primary, the ability for information to go from point A to point B has been a nightmare in some cases. A lot of doctors complain that that's a problem and that there's no really strong communication process, and so they are liking the idea of some sort of system that's in the cloud that doctors could be able to access and get information on their patients without having to go through red tape to get on the phone with the right person at this place and have it shipped over. And, depending on what kind of material it's on, if it's something like a disc or if it's something that could be sent electronically. And so some of the doctors think this is just the modernization of healthcare, taking advantage of technology to do that. I think the issue is, like the caller said, is that the lack of transparency makes us naturally skeptical, and the fact that the laws are so dated and not prepared to handle modern times makes it tougher for people to swallow.
And is it possible that Google could start charging doctors to use this service?
Oh, that's a good question, and I don't know. That is not something that we've gone down into, but right now, it's like I said, it's working with Ascension for free. It is, I imagine at some point, it wouldn't necessarily charge doctors, but I could see it working with healthcare systems and charging them. Say, yeah, we'll put your information in the cloud, and we charge X amount of dollars. So this is a project. This is an experiment with this system, and if it is successful and if they're able to do what they hope to do, it is possible that they'll go around to other hospital systems and say, hey, would you like to hire us? Here's what we've done with Ascension. We can do this for you.
Now that it's out there, how are Ascension patients responding to this? Is there any sense about that?
No. Well, bear in mind, this is still a project that's in the works. I mean, we're still in the early stages of it. This isn't the sort of thing that would happen overnight. So it's not something that's directly impacting patients at this time, at least not that we're aware of. But certainly there are probably test cases and examples out there where some people are probably participating, it's not clear. I think that right now it's a early days, and a lot of the process is just figuring out the technology part of it, making sure the data is transitions from one point to another and is organized in such a way that people would be able to look up something just like we have the ease with search now, but modernize it for the healthcare industry.
Are there any organizations, groups/people out there that are raising concerns about this?
Oh, absolutely. It has already triggered a federal inquiry as a result of the story. So federal regulators are looking into it, specifically the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Human and Health Services. So they're going to look for more information about this. And then we have a number of senators who have spoken up and voiced concern about the program. For example, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia has called for Project Nightingale to be halted pending an investigation. He wants a moratorium applied to any similar deals involving a company that's already under a consent decree agreement for serious privacy and security violations. And we know that's the case with Google, as I mentioned earlier, with regard to YouTube. We also have Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. She's a presidential candidate, and she said that Google's trove of health data warrants more government oversight because, quote, there are very few rules on the road code in place for regulating how it's collected and used. And that, again, refers to the datedness of the HIPAA law.
Right. But, you know, there's very few regulations anywhere in the United States when it comes to this kind of stuff. They don't, Congress likes to talk about it, but they don't take a lot of action.
Right, and right now, Congress is also, you know, looking into some of the big tech companies in terms of antitrust issues.
Right.
But it's always a very slow process. You know, HIPAA being enacted back in '96 is 2019.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time to revisit that. So much has changed. Technology moves very, very fast, but government tends to move in the opposite direction.
Except unless you're in the European Union, where they tend to act a lot more quickly when it comes to these issues. Is there any sense in the European Union or anywhere in the world where they're addressing this issue?
I'm not aware of it being addressed. This particular project is U.S. only.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that the regulators overseas are paying close attention to what's happening and want to know if Google or any other tech giant is partnering with a healthcare system on their turf. And so I imagine they're paying close attention, and the tech companies aware of the backlash, of the shock of this project coming to light. You can imagine they're being very careful and thinking about whether or not, you know, how they'll disclose what they're doing and when, if that's necessary.
Well, Sarah Needleman, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That's Sarah Needleman. She's a tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We've been talking about a new collaboration between Google and the largest U.S. nonprofit health hospital network, Ascension, in a deal that, among other things, gives the tech giant access to patient health data. We will continue with Tech Tuesday. We're going to talk about gift ideas with Russell Holley from Android Central coming up. So stay with us. If you have any questions about tech gifts, Russell can probably answer them for you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 165 million people will shop or are expected to shop between Thanksgiving Day and Cyber Monday, according to the National Retail Federation. And gifts of technology are on lots of wish lists, no doubt. Still, there are six fewer shopping days between Thanksgiving and Christmas this year, six fewer days to shop, and six fewer to compare deals and make wise choices. Russell Holley, contributing editor of Android Central, joins us to share his wisdom. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. You wanted to talk about AirPods. I knew we were going to talk about those in our gift planning sessions. So why are they so great?
Well, the biggest thing about them is their simplicity. The whole deal behind AirPods is that you kind of lift the case on them and they immediately pair to your phone. They can switch over. If you have more than one Apple product, they can conveniently switch over. They sound pretty good. The new AirPods Pro are great for people who want to be a little more physical. The previous version didn't hold up too well if you were a runner or something like that, but the Pro version sound a lot nicer and handle that kind of thing a lot better. But really, they're just, you know, they are the most convenient set of Bluetooth headphones, especially if you own more than one Apple product. Like that's really what it comes down to, is that you can get any number of really great Bluetooth headphones. This is, you're paying for a great deal of extra convenience with these headphones.
AirPods Pro, they cost about, well, more than $200. Are there any deals?
Yeah, so these are normally $250 headphones, and actually this is kind of unusual. They have started going on sales in places really just a couple weeks after they came out, which is atypical of what you would see with a lot of Apple products. The first generation is definitely on sale in a lot of places, but the Pro has actually gone on sale to be $20 and $30 off in a couple places in the last couple weeks, and it's expected that they're going to do the same across Black Friday in places like Best Buy and Target.
Mm-hmm. You think Cyber Monday brings anything, or is Cyber Monday even a thing anymore?
No, so it's really kind of fascinating. Depending on where you shop, it's that entire 5-day push from Thursday to Monday. Is it? It's not even. We don't call them individual days anymore. It's just that entire period.
It's the black long weekend.
That's right. Yeah. It's. I think I heard someone at Amazon call it Black November, and I wanted to just hurl my radio out the car when I heard that.
Yeah.
That's just not fair. But yeah. So you're gonna see. You know, if you're interested in just the first generation or second generation of AirPods. You know, you're going to see them drop way below their existing prices to, you know, to be, you know, $130 or $170, depending on which version you want. The AirPods Pro are going to hover still probably above $200, but you can probably get them for about $210 instead of $250, depending on where you shop.
And if I'm not thinking about using them for running or anything like that, are the older versions okay then?
Yeah, they're fine if, you know, just walking around the house and doing stuff. You know, they're still great headphones. They just, you know, they're not great for if you're the kind of person who wants a set of headphones when they go to the gym or something like that.
Are there any other? Can you use AirPods with anything but Apple products?
You can. You could use AirPods with Android phones. You can pair them to other things. You lose a couple features in the process because some of these things work in coordination with your phone. For example, the noise cancellation feature in AirPods Pro and the touch sensors across the sides don't work the same way when they are connected to, say, an Android phone. But you do still get the same audio quality when you're connected to them. And they do still pair just like any other Bluetooth thing.
What are good Bluetooth headphones wireless for Android users?
If you're looking for something that's pure wireless, you know, you've got Google's Pixel Buds. Samsung makes a set of headphones called Galaxy Buds. If you prefer the over-the-ear headphone experience and you've got a little cash to blow, Sony makes a really great set of headphones that has a name that is very, very complicated because Sony still doesn't know how to name products.
Oh, geez.
It is WX1003M.
My God.
Which, every time I see it, I go, I would love to recommend that to someone, but I am never going to remember that. So they're really good over-the-ear headphones that are wireless. They're studio quality headphones that audio professionals around the world use, but they are $350.
$350.
So I don't often, yes, and yeah. So as a result, I don't often recommend them unless I know that the person is very, very serious about having a quality audio experience. But
and can afford it.
Right, exactly. You know, you can get decent Bluetooth headphones for under $100, you know, in most places. Just be careful, you know, when you're shopping, especially in places like Amazon for Black Friday, and you see these kind of total wireless things that look kind of like AirPods, but they're only like $20 and $30.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason that they are only $20 and $30, and Black Friday has little to do with that price.
Okay. Amazon Fire TV, it's Amazon Fire TV Stick, and how does it compare to others?
Yeah, so Amazon, you know, has they always take Black Friday and drop all their stuff down to pretty absurd prices. The 4K Fire TV Stick is really one of the best that you can buy right now. It offers, 4K video streams for almost all of the apps that support it. For, you know, anyone who has a 4K television and wants something that's a little nicer than the interface that it came with, it has a friendly little remote that it comes with, so you don't have to use your phone to control it like you do Google's Chromecast, but, you know, you can use your phone to control it if you prefer it like I do. The remote gives you very simple volume controls and power controls. It just plugs right into the back of the television and has a single power cord that plugs in. If your television actually has a USB port in the back, you don't even need to take up a power slot. You can just plug it into the back of the television in most cases. Not in every case, but in most cases. And, you know, it just gives you access, you know, very simple access to Netflix and Hulu and YouTube and all of the streaming services, including the new Disney Plus, that you would be able to access through this one simple little stick instead of managing a bunch of different apps.
Why is it so superior to the other ones?
Really, just the biggest thing is the interface is super convenient and the price tag. You know, Amazon is able to really kind of jump on its price tag and make it so that this thing does everything for $25.
Okay.
You know, which is pretty considerable, and that's kind of Amazon's whole deal right now is that it offers a lot of the same stuff that you can get elsewhere, but it's you know often half the price.
You wanted to talk about Instant Pots. Now I know you're really into cooking, so you must use one yourself.
I've actually used a couple of these. I'm a big fan of the Instant Pot because it's like I have used pressure cookers before the Instant Pot, but this is a pressure cooker that has kind of microwave-friendly buttons on the front,
mm-hmm.
Which is cool because I'm kind of absent-minded and have a tendency to burn things inside of a pressure cooker. So I like having a thing that goes, hey, by the way, don't destroy your house. So this makes, you know, cooking in that format a lot easier, and they're often not particularly expensive anymore. These kind of started out as kind of $200 kitchen gadgets, but they've dropped down in a lot of cases to be under $100. In particular, this year, there are going to be a couple of the Instant Pot, the 6-quart models that are going to be around $90. If you are the kind of person who just kind of likes experimenting in the kitchen, this is really kind of a worthwhile thing. And there are just so many recipes for everything you can possibly imagine on the internet right now for Instant Pot things. Anything you can think of, you just type in your favorite thing and then add Instant Pot to the end of it. There's a good chance you'll find a recipe for it.
There are some that's Wi-Fi and Alexa enabled.
Yes. This is kind of a weird feature. Because what it really gives you is the ability to kind of check in on the progress and adjust it as necessary. It doesn't give you a whole lot else. So this is the same kind of weirdness that comes when there are a couple of microwaves that have Alexa enabled. It doesn't give you a whole lot of additional features. You still kind of have to be near it,
yeah,
in order to you know, turn it on and off. It's kind of the other features. So if you're someone like me who cooks something over, you know, kind of a 12-hour period, and you kind of adjust the temperature throughout the day, depending on what it is that you think you're going to need, you can do that. But you still kind of have to be near the Instant Pot to know whether you want to make that temperature change.
Right.
So I guess it's possible that you could video chat with someone and have them, you know, kind of take a look, or call someone and say, hey, take a look at this thing and tell me what you think. And then you could make changes there without trusting that person to push buttons on your thing for you.
Okay.
But it's difficult to imagine any other use case in which that internet connected feature is super useful, because, you know, these are designed to be kind of self-contained cooking machines. So it's interesting.
Someone did a survey on A friend did a survey on Twitter this morning asking if a turkey could be done in an Instant Pot. And I was one of the, I think it was 56 yes, 44% no. I was one of the no's, just because I don't own an Instant Pot, but they don't look that big.
Well, right. Yeah. I mean, even if you got kind of the 8-quart models, that's still not, you could probably do like the turkey breasts that come attached,
yeah,
to the rib cage still. Like, you could do that in an Instant Pot, but I don't know that I would do a full turkey in one, at least not the size that I would normally cook for my family.
So what devices can you replace with an Instant Pot?
I actually have replaced my pressure cooker, my slow cooker, so my crock pot I haven't used in forever, and my steamer. I actually replaced my vegetable steamer with it as well. It really just, you know, very quickly became this kind of self-contained thing that I use almost every night of the week.
Wow. How much time does it save? Or is that not the point?
So it really just depends. It ends up being very useful if I'm doing something, I'm cooking a bunch of things and I want to make some rice. It's a very quick kind of put in and not have to think about it, thing, instead of cooking rice on the stove. And the same goes for hard-boiled eggs. I use it a lot for very kind of simple, quick things that I would otherwise have to stand over the stove and do, whereas I can just push like a microwave. I can just push, you know, kind of simple buttons on it and know that when I hear that beep that it's done the way that I want it to be done. But everything else that I do with it is very similar to a slow cooker, where I'll put it in before I start my workday. I'll set it, you know, a 7-hour timer on it. When I hear that timer go off, I know that, like, you know, dinner is actually ready for the night.
What is the technology of an Instant Pot?
It's really just an inductive heat, you know, pin underneath of a set of removable, insertable pans, or pots rather.
Uh-huh.
So you put the pot in and you seal it, and it creates that kind of pressure seal. And the way that pressure cookers work is, you know, it just applies tremendous pressure and heat, and that cooks, you know, through things that would otherwise take longer to cook.
Does it cook things, like braise things, more efficiently quicker? Yeah.
You can set it to do that, but you run into kind of a similar problem that you described with the turkey, and that it has to be kind of smaller things.
Right. You couldn't do it like a rack of short ribs or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. If I was doing something like that, I would want a larger surface to cook on.
Gotcha. Okay. You also wanted to talk about the Microsoft Surface Pro 7. You've talked about that a lot. There's going to be a break on the price, so tell us about it.
Yeah, so I mean, Microsoft Surface lineup has a bunch of different sizes, and the Surface Pro is the one that's kind of designed for high-end users, someone who is looking for, you know, kind of the higher-end MacBook equivalent of something that runs Windows, and they are usually start around $1,000 for the whole system, including the keyboard and kind of everything that you would need to get going for this kind of higher-end system. Best Buy is going to have them right around $300 off for most of the models. So you could actually get kind of the lower end version of the Surface Pro 7 for as low as $700 in a couple places, which is really good.
Tell us about why you like the Microsoft Surface line so much.
I am just a sucker for the convenience of it. It gives me the ability to use it in kind of unusual spaces. The back hinge makes it comfortable for me to use when I'm on an airplane or when I'm, you know, kind of sitting on a couch in a way that hinged laptops tend to make me want to kind of sit up straight. It's essentially, it lets me lay down and be lazy and use my computer. and that's important to me sometimes. But also, it has kind of an active display on it with a stylus. And while I am a really terrible artist, I happen to know several incredibly gifted artists who have been able to take this and do just incredible things. And you just pull the keyboard off when you want to draw, and watching someone else do that is incredible. So if you are even remotely artistically inclined, then these are really fun. I'm pretty sure I've actually lost my pen, and I'm not actually sorry about that, because it is better off wherever it lives now.
It's being put to better use. What is the battery life like with that?
It very much depends on what it is that you're doing. These are smaller systems. So if you are just kind of a web browser person throughout the day, you could easily get, 7 or 8 hours of battery life out of this thing. If you plan on playing games, or if you plan on doing some intense, graphic design work or something like that, that battery life very quickly gets cut in half.
Yeah.
But you can functionally do both, which is kind of an important thing.
And as far as editing video and those kinds of things, how does that work?
You can edit video on this. The graphics card in it is capable, but certainly not the same experience that you would get from a desktop. But I have watched my video team use Surface products in the past to tremendous effect.
Okay. Hey, you and I are going to talk for the next couple of weeks about gifts. So we're going to talk about gifts for teens, gifts for little kids, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, we're going to kind of break down the different categories of people, and we're going to very cleverly avoid using any of the weird pet names that marketing people have come up for them in the process.
Okay.
Just because I think calling people millennials or Gen Z or whatever is absurd.
Agreed.
But
say, okay, boomer to me.
I would never. You ask me so many great questions. You definitely don't fit in that category. There's so many different things that are coming out this year, especially when it comes to some of the educational tech space. And I think that's probably where we're going to start is kind of educational tech that is available for kids is probably where we're going to start over the next week. But yeah, that's the goal, is to kind of pick a general age range and figure out things that work best for those people over the next couple of weeks.
All right, listeners. So be apprised of that we'll be talking more gifts coming up in the next few Tech Tuesdays that we have left before Christmas. It is a shorter span of time. We do have an email from Shadell about phones. She says, I've had a Samsung Galaxy in some form for the last 4 years. The Pixel has come out and improved in ways I never imagined. What are your thoughts on the new Pixel 4 and its use compared to Samsung's reliability?
So the thing that I struggle with when it comes to the Pixel right now is that the battery life on it is a little challenging compared to the current Samsung phone that is available in that same size. So my only caveat, really kind of struggle when it comes to recommending a Pixel phone is it depends on which size you're getting. I prefer the smaller version of the Pixel. I also prefer the smaller version of the Samsung Galaxy 11. If you prefer the larger versions of those phones, you will find that you get a lot more battery out of the larger version of the Samsung phone than you do out of the Pixel phone.
What's the difference in size?
There's about an inch and a half difference, between them as you go to hold it. It is kind of noticeable, the difference you get there when you go to hold them. And I just prefer the smaller version. It's easier to slide into my pocket. I guess I'm kind of weird that way. I definitely am surrounded by people who tell me I'm crazy and they prefer the larger phones because they can do more with them. They can, you know, if you're the kind to sit and watch shows while you're at work or something like that, first of all, good job hiding the fact that you're watching Disney Plus from your employer. I definitely applaud you for that. But also, it's, you know, it's just, you know, it's totally a personal preference. I will say that if you prefer the smaller phones, the Pixel 4 is just not for you this year. The battery is definitely going to be a downside.
Okay. Well, Russell Holley, as always, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's contributing editor at Android Central. He joins us every Tuesday for Tech Tuesday. And again, we're going to be talking about holiday gifts, and we'll have Russell's wisdom to guide us in that in the next few weeks. Thanks for listening. This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.